case, Mlynczak versus Rodman. Mr. Sherman.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel. I'm Mark Sherman. I'm appearing today, Your Honors, on behalf of the appellants Bernard Mlynczak, Thomas Ballaman, Jurgis Paluionis, and John Kasperowitz. Your Honor, we're here to discuss the district court's decision to grant the DOE's summary judgment motion, and to dismiss the claims of the four of several of the plaintiffs in this case. In particular, the DOE, just like the district court, argues that in dealing with the facts of this case, the most important thing to do, it appears, would be to separate each and every element, each and every aspect of the plaintiff's claims, and demonstrate that none of those elements, in isolation, would stand for the proposition that they should be permitted to get to a trial on the merits. Instead, what the plaintiffs have argued, the appellants have argued, is that this case, based upon the facts of the affirmative action plan, of what Anibal Taboas did in implementing that plan and encouraging others within his department to implement that plan, and then with regard to the Pavia hiring and the other actions, all need to be reviewed as a whole because they provide that mosaic. They provide the opportunity to see that, in fact, based upon the direct and circumstantial evidence.
Yeah, but when you add it all up, what exactly do you have? I'm not sure about it. I was struck. You complain about one of your facts in your mosaic is that most of the people that he hired were women or minorities.
That's correct.
Yeah. But if you add women to minorities, that's going to be most of the people, right?
Well, it's going to be...
Because you start with 50% women, and you have Hispanics, you have blacks, you have Asians, who, of course, are attracted to these scientific jobs, technical jobs.
There's no question.
So how do we know, you know, what would be an expected hiring rate from those groups when they're all lumped together?
I think that the statistical evidence, if that was the strongest aspect of the plaintiff's case to be presented to the court, should have been presented showing the pool from which those individuals were selected, because they tried to demonstrate for the court and presented evidence with regard to hiring during certain periods of time.
I understand. That's your burden, right? You're supposed to show that such statistics are meaningful.
That's correct, Judge. And they are meaningful to show Mr. Taboas and his own proclivity for hiring.
No, I don't understand.
No,
I don't understand.
Show that
if he's hiring in proportion to the representation of these groups in the hiring pool, then he's not discriminating, right?
But if at the same time the policies...
No, I don't get the same time. I mean, just suppose the only complaint was that he was favoring women, and half the people he hires is women. Well, you couldn't just say, well, he's hired half the women, so he must be discriminating in favor of women. You have to show that the pool somehow contained a lot fewer women.
I agree,
right?
With you, Your Honor.
So what information do we have about the pool?
We don't have information
about
it. But
then that statistic you harp on is completely worthless.
It's not worthless, but because it goes as
part... No, it's completely worthless. It's completely meaningless. Right?
Well,
suppose if you have blacks and Hispanics, women, Asians, suppose that's 90% of the pool, and he only hires 70%. So, I mean, that's possible. It's possible that he's, you know, that these people are still underrepresented, right?
Yes.
So you didn't do anything to negative that possibility.
I agree with that, Your Honor. The plaintiffs at the district court level didn't do anything to negate that possibility. What they sought to present before the court was the basic statistics to demonstrate that
they don't demonstrate anything. Don't you realize that?
No, I'm not saying to demonstrate anything by themselves, Your Honor.
They don't demonstrate anything in connection with anything else, because they say, suppose that the pool is such that he's actually hiring fewer of these minority people than their percentage in the pool. Well, then it would be part of the mosaic, but it would be the part that favored the defendant. You couldn't use it.
Yes, I understand, Your Honor. What I'm trying to indicate for the court is that even aside from those statistics, and they are only one small aspect of the
plaintiff's case. They're a small aspect, but they don't favor you. That's what you don't seem to understand.
No, I understand that they don't favor.
They can favor you if you don't have any information about the pool from which the hiring is being done.
But the other direct and circumstantial evidence in the case pertaining to both the Pavia hiring and also with regard to the actions of the Department of Energy, Mr. Tobias and others, following the hiring in connection with the reprisal, the retaliation, is in fact something that the court should have considered and should not have been simply dismissed as in isolation not being sufficient to allow them to get to a jury.
Now, retaliation is different. You can retaliate. I mean, you can retaliate against people for complaining, even though the complaint has no merit. In fact, that would be quite a natural type of retaliation, right? Someone complains about discrimination. It's no good. He's a troublemaker. So you throw him out or something. Of course, didn't happen here. So you have to separate them. You can't pour the retaliation into the discrimination claim. I think maybe you should have avoided the word mosaic. Nice word, but it can be an excuse for not thinking carefully about what the evidence is.
Apart from these numbers, which I actually would rather not call statistics either, what's your best evidence under either direct or indirect methods of proof that there was reverse racial discrimination going on here?
I think that the best evidence with regard to the Pavia hiring in connection with the Balamut and those related plaintiffs pertains to how the Pavia job was not posted, the fact that there was no posting, no evidence of posting of that position within the Department of Energy.
Why does that have a disproportionate racial impact? I mean, are you assuming that no one in the greater Chicago area is white?
No, I'm not assuming that at all.
It's posted for the public. It's advertised for the public at large, and it's not posted internally. And the question is, why would one from that fact draw an inference of racial discrimination in the process? Forget about who shows up in the end, whether it's Ava Pavia or whether it's anybody else.
I think that it pertains to several things. Number one, the fact that while it was allegedly posted outside of the Department of Energy to the public at large, the disputed issue of fact was that the Department of Energy, asserted that it was posted for a much longer period of time than, in fact, the evidence, we believe, would show at trial.
And why I don't know why that, if I heard that fact, why should I think that a rational trier of fact, you know, a jury or the court, depending who got the case, ought to draw an inference of differential treatment on the basis of race?
I think it's relevant because of the relationship that Mr. Tobias had with Ms. Pavia prior to.
That's a different piece of evidence. You have suggested that they had met on one other occasion.
That's correct.
And that at least makes you think, well, for whatever reason he wanted her as opposed to another woman, another man, you know, another anybody.
If I may finish to answer your question. And also the relationship between that and the fact that these individuals were qualified and experienced. It is disputed that they were more qualified than Ms. Pavia for that position, another issue that was not allowed to get to a trial. But
because you got to the point, I mean, the district judge jumps to pretext, and the district judge says, assuming your clients made out the prima facie case under the McDonnell-Douglas framework, it's then the privilege of the defendant to articulate a reason. They articulate the reason that they thought she was a better match for this job. They name her degrees, her past work experience, and now you have to show they're lying that that's really not what they thought. And those our laws suggest that's a very hard road to go down, because we do give employers some leeway in deciding who's qualified for jobs. We want something more than someone's patting themselves in the back for that point.
Well, the issue with regard to your first point, I think, is an important one. You make the point that the fact of the advertisement out in the public wasn't that neutral in many respects, because anybody could have responded to that. We believe that, as I said before, there's evidence that goes to a dispute as to how long and whether the mini-delegation process was properly used, and whether it was used for the purpose of trying to narrow, by Mr. DeBoas and Ms. Lyon, to narrow the actual publication and the actual dissemination of information, when they knew that the individuals within this department, Mr. Balamut, Mr. Malinchek, etc., would have applied. And in fact, comments have been made that they were eligible for those positions and qualified. The qualifications of these gentlemen is not in dispute. Then we go on to the next step about what took place after. And I do believe that it has relevance to whether or not that, whether the posting or the lack of posting and the subsequent testimony. For example, Mr. Hooper, James Hooper, testified that there were questions about the posting and the notice, and that there were changes implemented in the HR department following this situation specifically to make sure that posting would be possible and that it would be done. Elizabeth Lyon, who was directly involved with Mr. DeBoas, magically gets another job in a position assigned by Mr. DeBoas. The only involvement that she's had at that point is in making sure that the posting and that the position availability is worked through in the way that he wants. And again, there's other issues with regard to her work experience vis-a-vis the plaintiffs that is in dispute.
Not with regard to Pavia, though.
With regard to her supervisor experience, I believe that there was a disputed issue of fact as to whether or not she had as much supervisory experience as the others.
Yeah, but I mean, she had. So she's being hired. Is it correct? She's being hired for a position that places significant emphasis on hazardous waste disposal. She has a law degree. She has a B.S. in health physics and 9 years working with nuclear and hazardous waste. That sounds like a very qualified person, doesn't it?
I'm not saying that she wasn't a person of high qualifications. I'm saying that with respect to this position, it should be up to a trier of fact, based upon all the evidence that we have.
But the trouble with that, I mean, we've tried to stay away from saying the Department of Energy should have valued prior supervisory experience more than it did. I mean, that really does put us, I mean, it's repeated endlessly in the opinions of being the super personnel administrator,
right,
and so on. But it's not preposterous to think that the package of qualifications that Pavia had were a good match for the job, and maybe other qualifications would have been relevant. But why, as a matter of law, do you draw an inference of discrimination if the department didn't want, say, supervisory experience?
The question is a good one. The question also, however, seems to beg the issue of whether or not these plaintiffs had the opportunity to know that the job was to become available when they were told specifically that they would, in fact, be people who would be ripe for the job, that they should be looking at those positions in the GS-14 level. And if, as a whole, they were prevented from having the opportunity to be considered, their supervisory experience or otherwise, I think that's relevant.
How many people was she going to supervise?
I can't tell you, Your Honor. I know that the department that she was going to be in, but I don't know specifically the number.
That's kind of important if you want to emphasize supervisory responsibilities. Makes a big difference whether you're supervising 5 people or 1,000 people.
I agree. The Department of Energy indicated that supervisory experience was not an issue, and for that position to supervise the project, she was going to work directly with the project manager. That was going to be something that, at trial, we would argue was an important issue.
How could you argue at trial? You don't even know how many people she's going to supervise.
No, I don't. As I stand here today.
Pardon?
I say I don't. As I stand here.
Yeah,
today.
But you're supposed to have all your evidence, right? When summary judgment is right, you can't say, well,
you can't leave anything at the door. I agree.
Right. Want to save your time for rebuttal?
Yes, if I could. Thank you, Judge.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sherman. Mr. Johnson?
May it please the Court, Counsel. Your Honor, appellants focus on the mosaic of evidence, yet at no time during this litigation have they ever attempted to take the tiles of their alleged circumstantial evidence and place them in anything that remotely resembles a mosaic that directly points to a discriminatory intent for the hiring decisions at issue in this case.
Mr. Johnson, I can't resist saying, are you a New Yorker reader?
I'm not, Your Honor.
Well, the New Yorker, I don't think they do it anymore, but they used to have this little squib down toward the end of the magazine saying, block that metaphor.
Yes.
And I'm beginning to think that about tiles and mosaics and so on.
Yes, it's not a favorite of mine, but it certainly was harped on in the briefs. And, Your Honor, I think it actually helps walk us through this case, frankly, in terms of...
Yes. They're never getting rid of this one. Like Nexus, an obnoxious term.
Your Honor, what appellants have done here with their tiles is they've actually thrown them up against the wall. And, Your Honor, now that I've gotten actually laughter from the court and the gallery, I'll move on without that metaphor. Your Honor, let me go quickly through their alleged direct evidence. You pointed out the one piece, which is the alleged statistics. I'm not going to go any further into that. It's obviously the point of our brief that they're meaningless numbers. The other piece of alleged direct evidence are these quotes from Ms. Langenfeld and Mr. DeBoas. They're unrelated to the employment decisions here. Ms. Langenfeld is not a decision maker. And even if you look at the quotes, they're actually just vague quotes relating to their understanding or description of affirmative action. They don't go to discriminatory intent. The third real piece of evidence they focus on, of course, is the affirmative action program. And as we explained, the program itself, it's directed towards recruitment, towards education, towards outreach. It identifies barriers to equal employment opportunities and then goes on to identify action items to address these barriers. And nowhere in the affirmative action documents or in the action items does it suggest and certainly does not direct managers to hire less qualified women and minorities.
Mr. Sherman, it seems to me, giving Mr. Sherman the benefit of the doubt, it sounds like on the discrimination half of this case, what they are really trying to say is that the selection process was essentially rigged. They knew that Pavia was out there. They don't do an internal posting. They do a 9-day period of time, which is really de facto 3 or 4 days because the Thanksgiving weekend is in the middle of it. And they just manipulate the process so as to avoid having to hire these white men, and instead they hire a minority. Is there enough to sustain that kind of theory in this case?
Not at all, Your Honor. There are two major problems with the Pavia claim. One of them is this conspiracy theory, which I'll talk about. And then there's a second problem with regard to qualifications, which you've touched about a little bit. The first one, the conspiracy theory, the way I see it, it's sort of broken up into three different aspects. The first is this sort of vague, unusual hiring practices. Then the next two parts are the failure to post and the pre-selection. The unusual hiring practice, we explained in our brief that either the circumstances weren't unusual, such as using a mini-delegation system. It's not unusual at all. It was done hundreds of times in the 1990s. Or if it was unusual, there was an undisputed, unrebutted explanation. For instance, Mr. Baker wasn't the decision-maker here. He ordinarily would have been. He was on vacation for a month, and that's why Mr. DeBoas did it. So that's the unusual hiring practice, which I don't think amounts to even circumstantial evidence. But let's talk about the failure to post and the pre-selection. What they'd like to do is they'd like to say, let's get beyond mere speculation, even though I don't actually have evidence that Mr. DeBoas was responsible for either of these. I want you to give it to a jury, and I want you to let the jury make a reasonable inference. And the jury just can't do that here, Your Honor. Starting with the pre-selection, what the jury's got to do is, even though there's no evidence that Ms. Pavia was pre-selected, they've got to decide not just to discount Mr. DeBoas' testimony on this, But then to discount Ms. Pavia's testimony, in her deposition and in the summary judgment, she explained in detail how she came about to learn of the position here. None of it had anything to do with Mr. Tobias. She contacted Human Resources on her own. She applied for the position on her own. None of it at all had to do with a pre-selection. So a jury's not going to buy that. It's not a reasonable inference in this case. And if a jury,
well, you have to say you wouldn't even let a jury buy it. You wouldn't. You'd grant a Rule 50 motion before you sent it to them.
Exactly, Rana, which is why we shouldn't get past summary judgment. And if the jury, just to finish off the conspiracy, if the jury's not going to buy pre-selection, well, there's certainly no reason for the jury to buy that Tobias was responsible for the failure to post. I think you noted that in your comments to Mr. Sherman, which is, if there's no pre-selection, why in the world would Mr. Tobias decide to deep six the notice? Is there any evidence here in the record at all that the hiring pool of non-federal employees would somehow be more filled with minorities and women as opposed to internal DOE employees? No evidence at all. Reason number two why a jury should never see the Pavia discrimination case. Going back, I guess, to the Poo-Rucker. The Poo-Rucker, I think, is even probably more obvious and direct here. Mr. Tobias explained that he hired Ms. Poo-Rucker above Mr. Mlynczak because he believed that she was more qualified. And I think, without going into detail, that the record amply supports that. But what I find most interesting is that Mr. Mlynczak, in response, he doesn't dispute this. In his summary judgment brief or his Rule 56, he doesn't dispute that Ms. Poo-Rucker was the most qualified. Well, if he doesn't dispute that she's most qualified, he certainly can't establish a prima facie case. He can't establish pretext. And more importantly, it shows sort of the absurdity in a reverse discrimination case like this of trying to rely on affirmative action policy, no matter what the contours are. Any affirmative action policy as direct evidence of discriminatory intent in this selection. You can't very well come into court and argue, I've been subject to reverse discrimination, see affirmative action policy, and then turn around and admit that the woman hired was more qualified. You can't have it both ways. That's why the Poo-Rucker decision doesn't get to the jury. Finally, Your Honor, I'm going to turn to the Heston decision. The Heston decision is Mr. Mlynczak's third bite at the apple. The first two, of course, he's actually admitted he wasn't as qualified, both with regard to Pavia as well as Ms. Pura.
Admitted he wasn't as qualified or simply didn't contest?
Your Honor, it is more accurate to say he did not contest, which for purposes of summary judgment then would have to be taken as an issue of fact. I think there's evidence in the record to show that he didn't even have the minimal qualifications for certainly the Pavia, but he doesn't contest either, Your Honor.
Well, there's a big difference between the Pavia case and the Heston and the Pirat, however she says her name, case with respect to Mr. Mlynczak, isn't there?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, in terms of the Heston appointment here, Mr. Wunderlich actually admits that he thought both Mlynczak as well as Heston were equally qualified for the position. And he explains that under the circumstances, he had to appoint somebody for that position. The circumstances being that the APS project, the construction project they were working on, was coming to an end. He was concerned because of this that the position they were trying to fill would be defunded. He had to move quickly on this. He had to appoint somebody in there rather than go through the hiring process. The only way to appoint somebody is to take an existing GS-14 and transfer them into...
Who's this talking?
This is Mr. Wunderlich, who was the decision maker here, Your Honor, for Ms. Heston. And the only way to transfer somebody in is to take an existing GS-14 to transfer them into position. Mlynczak was a GS-13. He could not be transferred into that position. That's the legitimate non-discriminatory.
You're basically saying that the paperwork would have been required one way or the other, either to downgrade the position to a 13 or to upgrade him to a 14. Is that why he couldn't have been moved in? Otherwise, who cares? I mean, why couldn't it have been made a GS-13 position?
Well,
I
was
suspect not without some bureaucracy, actually.
Certainly, Your Honor, there would be paperwork. And the whole point of this case, frankly, is that it was the additional monetary compensation of a GS-14, which is at issue here. Certainly, to downgrade to 13, I don't think we would have seen a discrimination case here if that were the alternative.
Mm-hmm.
Against this legitimate non-discriminatory reason, Mr. Mlynczak comes up with no evidence disputing or undermining the veracity of the reason at all. And that's why this, as you mentioned, Judge Wood, it's a high standard to establish pretext. And here they don't have any evidence disputing Mr. Wunderlich's legitimate non-discriminatory reason. Finally, Your Honor, there is one final comment, at least on the discrimination, that I realize I missed, and I want to go back to the Pavia very shortly. I told you that there were two reasons it doesn't go to the jury. One is the conspiracy theory doesn't hold water. The second is, and as several of Your Honors had mentioned, is the qualifications again. That Ms. Pavia, in their discrimination claim regarding Ms. Pavia, they run into the same problem that Mlynczak ran into with Pooh Rucker, which is Ms. Pavia wasn't just nominally qualified. She was literally off the charts qualified for this position. And Judge Posner, you mentioned it. This was an environmental position with a focus on nuclear waste disposal. She had actually 11 years, as I look back at the Radford. Six of those were with Commonwealth Edison, where she had direct responsibility for radioactive management and waste disposal. She was actually supervising six nuclear reactors. She was hired into this position in large part exclusively because of her qualifications. And when you go back and you compare the appellant's qualifications against two of them, aren't even minimally qualified. They don't dispute this fact for purposes of summary judgment. And finally, Mr. Balamut and Mr. Kasperix, they do dispute this fact, but as Judge Wood pointed out, it's a high standard to establish that, in this case, Mr. DeBoas honestly thought that Kasperix and Balamut were more qualified, yet hired Ms. Pavia simply because she was a woman. I turn just briefly to the retaliation claims, Your Honor.
The statement of Wunderlich's, I may have to put a minority in that position. To show upper management, I'm willing to do these types of things. In what context was that made?
It was a conversation before the appointment of Ms. Heston, Your Honor, a conversation between Mlynczak and Wunderlich.
And she's the individual who probably has, between her and Mlynczak, it's a pretty close question on qualifications, isn't it?
It certainly is, Your Honor, and Wunderlich even admitted that he thought they were both qualified.
That's your weakest case.
I would certainly say it's not as strong as the other two, which I think are crystal clear, but this case also, as I mentioned, there's no reason to send this to the jury also, because in the burden shifting, there was an objective, legitimate, non-discriminatory reason raised by Mr. Wunderlich.
Which may or may not be the truth. This is the same guy who said that he might have to place a female in the position.
Well, Your Honor, I think the burden in pretext here is a high one. I don't think it's satisfied by simply coming up with evidence of an alternative intent here, which is really what they're saying by this statement. I think you need evidence to show that the underlying reasons that Mr. Wunderlich articulated are false. Not that he's a liar, but that the reasons are
a lie. If you're proceeding under the McDonnell-Douglas test, but if you
did, I'm sorry, Your Honor?
If you're under the McDonnell-Douglas test, if you're using that paradigm, but if you're proceeding on a direct evidence theory, an awful lot of circumstantial evidence, these people were, these people had a distinct bias toward women and minorities.
Well, Your Honor, we go through that in our brief, and I think, really, when you pare down the alleged circumstantial evidence, it comes up to zero, all of it. And this comment by Mr. Wunderlich, which is really what they're hanging their hat on, it's at most an ambiguous comment, requires several levels of inference. It wouldn't qualify as direct evidence in this case. So you would have to proceed under the McDonnell-Douglas burden shifting here. And the final point, Your Honor, the whole
Why wouldn't it qualify as direct evidence?
Your Honor,
we allow circumstantial evidence under direct theory.
Your Honor, I actually don't agree with that. I think our brief points out that none of the evidence that they identify as direct even qualifies as circumstantial evidence. I think this comment, even coupled with an affirmative action policy that doesn't actually allow preferences for less qualified minorities and women, wouldn't rise to direct evidence. It wouldn't create a mosaic.
Have you read our recent Rudin opinion?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Have you read Rudin?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I have.
It just came down. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
The final point, Your Honor, on the statement by Mr. Wunderlich, and the reason that it doesn't even I don't think arise to circumstantial evidence in this case. Is the whole point, apparently, of that is that Mr. Wunderlich allegedly at one time made a statement that seemed to suggest that for affirmative action purposes, he may have to put a minority in that position. Well, Your Honor, the statement wasn't a general invidious statement towards white men. It was very limited and very focused regarding the objectives of affirmative action. The action he took here, which is to appoint a GS-14 to a GS-14, doesn't advance at all the policies or goals of affirmative action. And that's why it's, I guess, a third or fourth reason why this, albeit vague, statement wouldn't even rise to circumstantial evidence here. Unless there are further questions, Your Honor, thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mr. Sherman.
Thank you, Your Honors. I reserved a short amount of time, and I'd like to address one thing in particular in response to the last colloquy that you had. The Wunderlich situation is important. The comment that was made ties in because the testimony at trial would be that Wunderlich told Malinchak that he was qualified and he would be listed for the position, and he never was. Now, that coupled with the fact, close in proximity, that he told Malinchak that I may have to put a minority or a woman in that job to please upper management, or words to that effect, does become important. It does become a key part of the Heston review.
It's the kind of thing you say to a person when you don't want to give them the job, madam. You want to shift the responsibility to someone else, right?
Well, I don't know that.
You say I'm just doing this because you know I have to keep these
There's no evidence. I don't think there is or has been argued by the DOE that Wunderlich needed any reason why he couldn't be honest with
No.
I understand.
People are not honest when they're firing people, right?
But this wasn't a firing.
Denying them a promotion. They give an excuse so the person will still like them.
There's no question that that can be done.
Right.
In the context where this case is, I think that with the interaction between Wunderlich and his position, Malinchak, a direct subordinate who's being told he's qualified, you're going to be listed, who later is told that, in fact, he's not listed for the position, and one of these reasons comes up, I think that in and of itself is more important.
But do you think a comment by that comment alone would get you to a jury?
In light of all the other facts, I believe
What are the other I never get a good idea from you what the other facts are. We threw out the... What are these other facts?
Well, we were talking about the fact, as I set forth in my brief, Your Honor, that we deal with Mr. Tabois and the comments and statements made by him, both in connection with the Pavia situation and otherwise. Your Honor has heard my argument and read my discussion with regard to the actions of Tabois and others in retaliation and reprisal immediately following, and in fact not following, during the EEO complaint process, to chill that process. We've also reviewed in our brief the facts that go to the not just Heston, but also our argument with regard to Prewecker. Now, Prewecker is probably the weaker of the...
Okay, well, your time is...
I was just trying to answer your question, Judge.
Yes, of course.
I have one other question for you, if I may,
sure.
Mr. Sherman. Your colleague suggested to us that Mr. Malinchak has never really challenged the fact that his qualifications are... equal to or exceed those of Ms. Prewecker. Is that correct, the way she pronounces her name? That was the suggestion that we received from the government. I'd like to have your view on
my that. Understanding of the testimony that was put forth before the court, Mr. Malinchak's 56.1 statement, was that his qualifications were at least equal to Ms. Prewecker's qualifications, not that he conceded or in any way failed to address the fact that Ms. Prewecker was more qualified or should have received that position. In fact, that was one of the reasons why he believed he should have been considered for that.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you for your time.
Okay, well, thank you to both counsel. Next case for argument, United